Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book. I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed, and then everyone can download it and listen to it and enjoy it. And if you do enjoy it, feel free to send feedback to luke@juggler.net, or even better, if you don't enjoy it, feel free to send that feedback. Thankfully, quite a few people have been enjoying and sending in feedback about some recent episodes. It seems like quite a few people are a fan of Juliana and her sharing of opinions about books from she's been reading science fiction for a long time, but not into it hardcore like I am in a science fiction reading kind of thing. We will get around to our Solaris review. We both read the book, and I listened to the audiobook, and we're watching movies. We've got one final Solaris movie to watch, and then we'll get on and do a big review of that. We would have got to a bit quicker, except that I was super ill last week. I'm away on a work trip at the moment, so I've got time to do these reviews and catch up with quite a few reviews that I've not got to so far. But I was very ill. I don't want to go into the details because it's a bit too graphic. So just to say that my stomach wasn't very well. Anyway, so because of that, I didn't really get around to it. We didn't get around to watching this other movie and doing the review. But I've got this book that I did also complete in that time when available. I'm a few books behind. There's some other books that I've not got around to reviewing, but I thought I'd just get straight on to this one. So the book that I'm going to be reviewing today is called Mogworld, by an author called Yahtzee Croshaw. It was published, it says here on goodreads.com, it says published in September of 2010 by Dark Horse Comics, and it's 413 pages. And the reason I read this book is because I was watching some videos by Yahtzee Croshaw. That's his, I think his name, is it Ben Croshaw or something? Anyway, but his online persona that he uses to review video games in small videos under the title of Zero Punctuation. I'm a big fan of his videos. I mean, I don't watch them regularly, but whenever I remember, I go and check out some of the latest ones. And these are like these little 5-minute videos with these little cartoon characters talking about video games. And it's called Zero Punctuation because if you think that I sometimes speak quite quickly, I have got nothing on Yahtzee when he does his video reviews, because he speaks as fast as possible, which is why it's zero punctuation. It doesn't sound like there's any punctuation to any of his sentences. He just moves on from one thing to the next. So I've noticed it many times underneath the videos. It says, yes, and he wrote a novel and he makes video games. And, you know, he's one of these kind of generally creative people. He reviews video games, but he also has a series of video games, which I must admit I've never played or tried or anything like that. He writes reviews and essays and other material, but he had a novel, and I thought, well, let's just look at it. And I realized that it was on Audible, so I was like, okay, I'll just give it a go. I've got plenty of Audible credits left, so even if I didn't listen to it. So what I found interesting about this whole setup is that it's a book by a critic, and, you know, there's that whole thing, well, you think you can do better, and of course, as I said, Yahtzee does make his own computer games, but this is strange because it's like, you know, Yahtzee often talks about storytelling and good storytelling versus bad storytelling, and characters that you care about versus characters that you don't care about, and, you know, why you should care about characters in computer games, and it's, and in this way, it's not very common to see, like, original creative output like by a critic in a different area. I mean, sometimes critic, like movie makers, of course Roger Ebert died recently, and I read some a movie that he had helped write, but, you know, it wasn't what I'm trying to say is it's always interesting to see a critic put out some work. I've mentioned before as well, like if you hear some writing advice from an author, you should always read their work first to see if the advice is good or if it's applicable to your own work or anything like that. And here it kind of have the opposite, like, or maybe not the opposite, but some, like, a different take on that same idea, is that if you read something by a critic, like a book critic, you can kind of see what they think is good or what they think is good enough. And then you can judge their criticism in a new light. So, example, if you want to know what I think is a good book, you could read one of my novels, because while I don't think all of them are great, I think they're all good enough and interesting enough at least to put out there and let people download them and read them for free, at least. But anyway, so you can check out, so you can see a critic in a new light if you read or view or take part in some of their work in some way. So actually, I had really no idea what to expect about this. I saw the front cover of the book, and it looked like a zombie on it, and I thought, presume, well, it was going to be something fantasy related and maybe horror related. I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen. And I thought, well, as he talks about computer games, I mean, he is a computer game critic, it's probably got something to do with like computer games. So in the novel, we meet Jim, and Jim is in a magic school, and I was like, oh, is it going to be more Harry Potter-like? But he dies very, very quickly, very early on in the novel. It's really not a spoiler at all. It's right there in the opening chapter, and he heads towards heaven, and then as he's approaching heaven, he gets turned around, and he's been resurrected by a necromancer. And things have changed in the world that he returns to, because now there's been what's called this infusion. I think it's the infusion. And now whenever anybody dies, they come back to life again in the nearest church. And it's kind of like a recent change. I think it happened like maybe 15 years in the history. So Jim had been dead for about 60 years and he comes back and everything's changed. And so when I was reading this, I was thinking, well, is this a computer game? You know, like, because people dying and coming back to life again, and he comes back to life by necromancer, which is I'll get a bit onto that in a bit more. But there's these different ways, you know. Of course, when you die in a computer game, you get an extra life or you get another life, and so I had this this thing going on in my brain, going, well, are the characters, in a computer game, or are the characters in a computer game and they're being played by characters, or are the characters, you know, the non-player characters, the NPCs, I think they're called. And then immediately you're thinking, well, do they have free will? Or do the characters know that they're in a computer game? I watched Wreck-It Ralph recently, and I think it's a really fun movie. But then, of course, everybody knows the rules of the world. It's like, okay, I am a computer game character. I know I am, because I can see other computer game other computers in this arcade through there, and we go into this character, you know, we meet different, so everybody knows all of the rules of the game. And then I was thinking, well, are we reading kind of like an abstraction of what an outside observer, you know, is projecting onto the characters? And this was made like more interesting as I was reading through this book at the very beginning of the book, where I wasn't quite sure what was going on or quite sure what the world is like. For example, there's a character called Slippery John, and Slippery John always talks in the third person. So I was saying, well, maybe Slippery John is a player controlled one, like in a game of Dungeons and Dragons. You talk about your characters like, oh, my character does this and my character is thinking this. So Slippery John is thinking this. Isn't Slippery John? Yes, Slippery John is thinking. But Slippery John was talking in the third person, so I was thinking, well, is he a player king? And like I say, with the knowledge of an outside world, but you still know you're in a game. There's a web comic called Order of the Stick, and the Order of the Stick, the characters, they have no knowledge that they're in a game, or they've got no knowledge of the outside world, or there's an outside world to the game, at least I don't think so. But they do know about the rules of the game. They talk about hit points and experience points and all these other different kind of things, and they use all of the different paraphernalia that you get in these, like online role-playing games or just normal role-playing games, I guess. So mild spoiler here, which I think is actually given away even in the let me have a look on the Goodreads page. I have this open even though I'm not on the internet here. A team of programmers, yeah, so it actually even mentions in the blurb there on Goodreads that he is actually, in fact, this is actually taking place inside a computer game. And it turns out that all of the characters, or at least most of the characters, are kind of involved. They're evolved in-game characters who have become self-aware. And even, you know, we're not sure if anybody outside of the game knows that they're self-aware. But they live in this world which has been simulated to create as much adventuring possibilities as possible. And then, so the idea being that real-world players will take over an existing character like on the server and then go on adventures too. So they can either go on adventures with other normal humans or go on adventures with other like in-game characters. And it's quite funny when this is actually presented in the in the novel itself, because these characters suddenly get the syndrome and they talk in like text speak and like say GG and BRB or brub. And then they do like these single moves over and over again, and they walk as though they're not being controlled, you know, organically, but being controlled via, you know, keyboards and mouse. More on that later. Otherwise, the world is very much like, and I guess it is very much a parody of the massively multiplayer online role playing games, the Mormorpgs, or however you pronounce it. Which, of course, that's where the name of the book comes from. Mog World is a massively, or like a multiple, what would it be, like a anyway, some MOG mog, massively online game or something. So you've got just like your Dungeons, well, not Dungeons and Dragons, much more of a what's it called, World of Warcraft. So you've got your wizards and your mage and your adventurers and your orcs and your castles and dungeons and all that kind of stuff, priests, and because they're in the game world, sometimes they actually hit the limit, so they get to the top of the world or get to the bottom of the world and they fall into the black space and there's the cracks in the programming and stuff like that. Now, I've never actually played World of Warcraft or any other MMORPGs, so I only know about it through, you know, just existing in the modern world and being on the internet, and you kind of pick a lot of stuff up by osmosis. But I'm sure there's loads of jokes which went straight over my head. But even so, I think there's a lot of references, and it is actually a good parody of. I think it's a good parody not just of the games itself, but a lot of the commentary seems to be about the people who play the games. And if you've seen any of the zero punctuation videos, any of Yatz's videos about games, you'll probably understand his views on the people who views on these World of Warcraft kind of games and the people who play them. Anyway, so let's move on to the story. So Jim is kind of unhappy with his life, and then he dies and he's brought back to life, as I've already mentioned. But one of the main things that makes his character, to me, quite interesting is that he wants to die. But he is a zombie. He is undead. And there's this great scene where all of these undead zombies, like a whole graveyard full of zombies, comes back from life, and the necromancer goes, "And now you are mine to control." This is right in the beginning of the book. I'm not spoiling anything. And all the zombies look at each other and go, "Really? Really? Are you sure?" And he says, "Yes, you are mine to control. Come with me and we will fight, and I will be your lord and you will be my minions." And then they look at each other and say, "I'm really not sure. Really not sure we want to be. Really not sure you're going to be your minions. What's in it for us?" "Oh, well, you'll get, you know," and there's all this different stuff. But of course, Jim, he doesn't want to be a minion, so he is he doesn't want to be undead. He just wants to be dead. So he kills himself, and then his soul gets put back in his body. He doesn't go to heaven, and then his body is still alive again, but undead again. So he doesn't feel any pain. He doesn't have to eat or sleep. He doesn't really have any of these things that would normally cause you discomfort, except that he has the continuing discomfort of being in a body which doesn't work properly, and he gets patched up by other characters and continuously patching himself up. But he wants to die. But he doesn't want to die and be put back into a body which is slowly crumbling into smaller and smaller and less capable bits until you just have awareness in these bits of like leftover grains or ashes of body parts that are strewn around that you then have to live forever as a self-aware bit of dirt with no agency. He just wants to die, not properly die. So he gets into, throughout the book, he gets into many, many different scrapes, and he's in battles, and he could die, but he if he does, he doesn't properly die, but he wants to die. So the whole book is pretty much the main quest in this book is that Jim, he wants to find somebody who can make him not just die but not exist. He wants to be totally gone. So in any point, he actually wants to survive just so he can die properly. And I found this quite an effective storyteller. He literally goes in search he goes in search of God. But he doesn't want eternal life. He's actually seeking the end to eternal life. And I thought that was quite an interesting main story. Unfortunately, there are quite a lot of subplots throughout the book about the, you know, the politics of the world and other stuff that's going on in the world. And there's some, you know, stuff that, you know, about the game developers that kind of bleeds over into the activities of the characters on Mogworld. And there's so many of these subplots. I thought, well, are they all going to be tied up by the end? And they were. And then, even though everything seemed to be tied up, I thought, well, what can be left over? We've still got like an hour and a half left of this audiobook. And then it drags a bit more. And then I thought, oh, well, this is definitely the end. And then there's this like another quest and another boss level to beat. I guess that's a bit more before an hour and a half. But then once you get to an hour and a half, yeah, then there's this like epilogue, and then there's another attempt at an epilogue, and then there's a third attempt at an epilogue, and then after the last epilogue, there's this little like Yahtzee, like zero punctuation like review of the Mogworld game from outside of the game world again. I just think it was just going on too much. So overall, I think the story, the base story was good, but it was padded out. It felt padded out by all of the subplots, and all, even the subplots felt padded out because so many of them would involve like a big battle sequence or a big chase sequence. There's over 13 hours of like audio content to get through, over 400 pages in the novel. And this book really could have been about two-thirds, like half or two-thirds of that length. You know, and then each chapter of the, you know, the adventure, the story that he goes on would have had a lot more punch. You know, like by the massive, I've got a note here, by the third massive battle, I kind of lost interest in massive battles. And, and the subplots took, reading through my notes here, subplots took a bit too long to be introduced. And then each time you spent time on them, it took you away from the main quest. And also, finally, like I said before, there was this, the death, like the drama, the tension couldn't come from the death because these characters were undead and they could come back to life. And even the undead, the non-undead characters, the normal characters, when they died, they would come back to life and just be resurrected in the nearest church. So a lot of this, like peril, a lot of the tension that came, that would normally come from a big battle, kind of didn't, it really wasn't there for me. People who play these World of Warcraft games, they've invested a lot of time into each character, and if their character dies, then they've got to go back and restart and then go on another quest, or they let the teams down in a, what's his name, Jenkins, Jenkins, I can't remember the quote. Leroy Jenkins, you know, he runs in there and everyone else runs in after, what are you doing? And all that kind of stuff. You think, well, there's actually some, you know, there's some peril there because people have invested a lot of time into these characters. And I hadn't really invested that much time to care about them too much when I knew that if they did die, they could just come back to life in the nearest church, etc. Anyway, so moving on to the characters. Jim, our main character, not particularly likable. He has Yahtzee's voice and his character. It's pretty much Yahtzee as his character, as the zero punctuation reviewer, like injected into a game that he is continuously reviewing. So he's very, it's very cynical and blunt. Thankfully, it's actually quite funny. And I'm actually speaking now like Jim in the book. I don't think so, but thankfully he's quite interesting because he's not a hero, but he's being dragged into the role of a hero, I do think. Anyway, that's literally like listening to the whole book. It's talking someone very sarcastically. I do think this could get a bit annoying over the course of an entire 13-hour audiobook of someone continuously talking as though everyone around him is an idiot, don't you think? A bit too much, I mean, I quite like Monty Python, but sometimes there's a little bit too much of a John Cleese talking down his nose at people when you're reading this. But anyway, so you get onto Meryl, which is another undead character who mostly patches up Jim when he dies. That's her kind of main job, but she's also a bit of a love interest, I guess, kind of thing. Quite obvious from the very beginning. And then who else do we have? Yeah, Thaddeus is another undead thing. He's a priest who is constantly confronted by the fact that that his belief system is a constructed belief system that he is ascribed to, but doesn't match up with the reality of, or the non-reality of the world. You know, he constantly his faith is being stretched or shattered by evidence that there's other things in the world that he doesn't understand. And yeah, these main characters, they all have missing body parts and lots of undead gore, you know, eyes popping out and bones popping through skin and internal organs leaking out through your ears and your bowels and stuff like that. There's actually, I really quite enjoyed a lot of the descriptions of the squeaky undead people. And then I mentioned before, there's a, oh, maybe I didn't mention before, I can't remember. Anyway, Slippery John. Yes, I did mention him before. He's one of my favorite characters. He has a Scouser accent and he speaks in the third person. And he has this adventurer, this female adventurer character who has the syndrome, who he has a love affair with. which is actually, I'll talk about that later. So yeah, that's kind of the main band of adventurers who travel alongside Jim and who have their own side adventures and their own subplots and things. And then you get the bad guys, there's Simon, who I actually quite enjoyed as the main villain in the piece, even though I don't want to give it away. I think there are a few parts of it which seem to be a little bit lazy about his character, even though we never really see him up close. And then you get these characters like Mr. Wonderful, and I was, again, you're not quite sure he was written into the Mogworld world, the game of Mogworld, as an evil character, but due to the fact that Mogworld is like this, it evolves, and the characters in this evolve, he suddenly has free will, and then he's an evil character who likes torturing people and killing people, but then the people he kills, they're no longer... that they all come back to life again automatically, so he has to find other ways to be evil. And then at some point, you're not sure if he's meant to be good or if he's meant to be evil. Anyway, quite strange. I think the biggest problem for me in the book in terms of characters was the character of Barry, who turns out... first of all, he starts off as just this minor character. And then suddenly we're in his mind, or in his head, as like a viewpoint character, I think. And then he kind of disappears for a bit. And when he comes back, he's suddenly a major character. And this caught me out because, like, when characters are introduced, if they're going to be a main character, I want to think, hey, this person is interesting enough. I wish I could spend more time with them. And then when you do spend more time with them, you're like, oh, that's great. I'm glad this person is now a main character. It's not like, now this is a character and we're going to describe them in a lot of detail because we're going to be spending them a lot of time with it. You know, there's different ways of introducing a character. This reminds me a bit of the Rastafarian guy in Neuromancer, because he turns up and there's been lots of characters who turn up in the same way, who turn up and they're there for like that one scene or that one little bit, or they're in this one city and they leave the city and they leave the character behind. But this one guy just turns up and suddenly for the last third of the book he's like a major character and doing big plot things and sticks around and is important for the rest of the book. And I was just like, oh, I wish I'd have remembered his introduction. I wish he was interesting at the very beginning, because now he has all this important stuff to do. I wish I'd have, you know, been able to identify with him or had anything to remember about him. And I felt Barry was very much like that. When he turns up, he was just like, oh, okay, that's one of many minor characters and one of the less interesting of the minor characters that he had so far, and suddenly he turns out to be a big thing, and I never really remembered where he had come from or why he was such a big deal in the book. But again, that's kind of the point of his character in a way. So overall, I think the character work was pretty good, even though it did sometimes feel a bit annoying that Jim, our main character, was just always annoyed with everybody around him and always seemed like he was talking through clenched teeth about the people around him who were just so stupid. Anyway, so getting on to the writing, what I actually really liked about this book is very funny. Lots of really good jokes, and like I say, there's lots of parodies about different things, about, you know, computer games and religion and all that kind of stuff. And the audiobook is narrated by Yahtzee Croshaw himself, and it's very strange to hear him speak so slowly, because again, as I mentioned at the beginning of this review, if you know him from his videos, he speaks very, very quickly, and there's, you know, every line is a joke and everything. But here he's doing his own narration, and this works in some ways because he does a good job of like delivering. What I'm trying to say is that some of the jokes, you kind of need to hear them, or it felt like you need to hear them, because if you'd have read it, you wouldn't have read it in the same kind of sarcastic, cynical tone of voice. So in some ways, it helps that he delivers his own lines, but unfortunately, he's not a professional, and I know this is a bit strange to complain about, but like, I'm used to hearing professional narrators, professional actors reading out books, and while Yahtzee has a lot of experience narrating videos and stuff, you need to know when a funny voice, how long a funny voice is going to stay funny, and how long an annoying voice you can do before it gets too annoying. For example, like, if you're going to read out the voice of a computer, or like a computer printout, and you read it in the voice of a computer, like, this is going to be like this, you can keep that up for maybe three lines, and then it starts getting annoying, and then it starts getting painful. You know, it can be funny, and these annoying voices can be funny once or a little bit. And at the end, when there's one of the epilogues, which is more written in a more kind of like epic fantasy style, and so he decides to read like this, except sometimes the character is also talking in a voice like this, and it's sometimes very difficult to tell when it's a character who's actually talking and if it's a character, or if it's just Yahtzee narrating in a character's voice and then switching to a voice for the actual dialogue. Anyway, it gets a bit tricky. And also, I could hear the pages turning as Yahtzee was reading. Sometimes you could hear pages turning, which kind of took me out of the story. When I heard the kind of the cracks behind the audio production of the audio book. However, I do think it is good that someone like who has written a book does narrate it themselves. I mean, it doesn't happen very often, so it is a bit of a treat to hear the author's own opinion or own delivery of the jokes that he's done. So that does work out pretty well. The writing, like I said, there is a lot of writing, and then I got to some really good, these great metaphors and similes. I wrote one down here on my phone as I was listening to it. He's talking about a bad guy, and he says, when he spoke, his voice hissed like the wind that whistles through the branches of a dead tree right outside your bedroom window on the night your girlfriend broke up with you. And there's so many of these lines that I would listen to and then laugh out loud about it just because it is actually very clever writing. But then I was thinking, wait, how does Jim know what it's like to be dumped by a girlfriend? And is there going to be trees outside of his window? And I was like, well, do windows exist in this mug world? And then, but has he ever had a girlfriend? It didn't seem to quite fit in with that. And then I noticed a pattern that so many of these similes and metaphors and other things, they came from a world which Jim couldn't know. They came from our world. Like, you know, it talks about things snapping like celery. And you just go, well, is there celery in there? Yeah, there probably is. Oh, it felt like I was hit by a 10-ton truck. And you're like, well, would there be 10-ton trucks inside of a world which Jim could know? So even while a lot of these jokes kind of made me laugh, they made me think and just go, well, that's not quite right. And then I started thinking, well, maybe this is like, it's not Jim who's narrating it in the first person. Even though it is in the first person, it's somebody else writing Jim's story in the first person, a bit like Slippery John narrates his own feelings and dialogue in the third person. Slippery John is going to go and do this now. I think Slippery John doesn't want to do this. Slippery John should go and do that. And he's actually the guy saying that. So he's talking in the third person about himself. So I was thinking, well, maybe someone's doing that, the first person, about Jim's story. For example, there's a book by Verna Vinge called Deepness in the Sky, and there's these spider-like aliens on this planet, and the humans around the ship are keeping an eye on these spiders, and these spiders are, you know, they're doing their thing, but the humans don't want to look at the ugly spiders. They can't understand the writing, what the spiders are saying or doing anyway, and how they're communicating. So the computer, and I think characters like these people on the spaceship around the planet where the spiders are, recast the stories in, like, the true stories that are happening elsewhere in human characters with human voices, and they act them out, and the computer animates them. Or I can't remember everything that happens there, but you do get this idea that the characters in the book are viewing the spiders through the lens of human experience and kind of projecting onto them their own human, like, things, their own human images and their own human characteristics. And so they don't use the metaphors and similes and analogies that the spiders would use. They bring and sort of project onto them their human ones. And in that book, it works so great because you're actually seeing the spiders as well, not through the lens of the humans on the ship. You're actually seeing them directly too, and Verna Vinge is telling their stories. But then when he says, oh, and he was in a sports car and he was driving along here with his girlfriend beside him, you go, okay, but this is a spider with eight legs and his girlfriend isn't a girlfriend, it's another spider. So what is actually a sports car in this way? And it makes you question at all times, like, what is real in this situation, and why is he using these analogies which they may or may not have in the actual situation? And so, if I'm being super charitable, you could actually cast Jim's story being told after the fact, like the computer, because he's a computer character, or he's a character within a computer game, did the computer keep track of his log file? And then somebody, and because he turns out to be important in this computer simulation or in this computer world, did then somebody go through and look at what he was doing in his log file? And then a human character within the Mogworld universe, but not within the Mogworld world, but outside of that, in the real space, in the meat space, or whatever it is, did they do a first-person novelization of a non-player-controlled character in his journey throughout a massively multiplayer online role-playing game called Mogworld? And is that now? I honestly think it's clumsy writing, but it's clumsy writing that made me laugh, and then also clumsy writing that made me want to make excuses of why this writing was really clumsy, even though I think that massive diversion into that big excuse isn't actually relevant. But anyway, that's it's fun enough writing and an okay reading for a non-professional. However, like you say, Audible does spoil me, or like listening to so many professional audiobooks really does spoil me in terms of readings. And so I might as well just do an Audible ad here. You can get a free audiobook if you sign up for Audible. If you go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, you can go there and sign up for a free account. Well, it's free for a month anyway. And in that time, you can download any audiobook that you want. I wouldn't suggest listening to Mogworld as a first audiobook, because like as I said, it isn't the best example of a professional actor doing a narration of a book, but I think it is interesting. So you can check out, there's like 100,000 other titles to check out. So if you want to help support the SFBRP, you can by going along and checking out audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and you can help support the podcast, and also you can support your own reading. You'll get a lot more reading done if you can listen to books as well as read them. At the moment, most of my reading is of my fiction reading anyway is by audiobook, mainly because so much of my normal reading time is taken up by some non-fiction reading and research that I'm doing at the moment for other projects. But yes, check out Audible. I'm a platinum member. I get through 2 books a month, although I'm a bit behind. Anyway, let's finish off this review by getting on to talking about some of what I normally finish up with these is talking about the themes of the book, or why I find books interesting. Because no matter how good the story, no matter how good the plotting and the characters and stuff like that, what makes a book really sing for me is if it makes me think. Now, I'm sure lots of other people, have good opinions, of like issue-based science fiction, like this is going to be a book about free will, or this is going to be a book about religion, or this is going to be a book about, you know, economics or something. And a lot of people, well, let me put it this way, a lot of authors seem to go, well, this is what the book is going to be about, and try and like railroad the book into those things. One author who I think does this quite a lot is Ted Chiang, and Ted Chiang normally writes short stories, and most of those stories I don't mind being about a single issue, because it's like, okay, what if religion was true? Let's go with this. And I'm like, yes, awesome. Old Testament religion with gods and angels and all of that kind of stuff. What would it actually be like? And he can spin a really good tale about this. I reviewed his short story collection called The Story of Your Lives and Others. And I think some of those, over half of them, I thought were genius. A few of them I thought were good. And then three of them I thought were pretty forgettable and a bit too heavy-handed. Later on, I read, again by Ted Chiang, The Life Cycle of Software Objects. Now, I didn't review it for this podcast because it's only a novella, and I don't think it would have been... I didn't think it was substantial enough to actually do a full review here. But I did write about it on goodreads.com, so you can probably check out my review there if you look at The Life Cycle of Software Objects. I do think it's actually worth reading in a way, because it's not long enough to be really bad. But I know that's like very damning with faint praise, but it is actually too long. I think he normally writes short stories. This would have worked okay as a short story, but he expanded out to novella length, which without actually adding any other interesting or good ideas, it doesn't have the plot to sustain a full novella in that way. Anyway, that is about these constructed machine intelligences that, you know, become self-aware. Unfortunately, they take a lot of time to develop. You know, they take as long as a human to develop, to grow up and learn. And the life cycle of software objects is, in my opinion, a very tedious story of people who want to keep their software pets alive. And it just feels like it never ends. It's just again and again and again. And I felt nothing but pity for the human characters who dedicate their entire lives and all their money and their entire, you know, everything like that to save these software entities, these software objects. And nothing about them interested me, which, and then I was thinking, well, I'd be able to get through this if the software entities themselves were really interesting. Unfortunately, I didn't feel anything for them because they were too cute and lovable. And if you remember one of my main criticisms, or one of my criticisms of Little Fuzzy, it was that it's very easy to think something is worth saving if it's cute and likable, and a bit like the quaddies in the novel Falling Free, which I reviewed a few episodes ago too. Same kind of thing with Little Fuzzy. If someone is really cute and they're self-aware and they're intelligent and nice to look at and warm and fuzzy and make you feel, oh, look at these, of course it's very easy to say, well, yes, they should be worth saving. And if you remember in Little Fuzzy, I actually said what I really want to see, what I really want is a book like this, like a story like this, but we, instead of saving things that are nice and cute and fuzzy and charming and self-aware and intelligent, that they're self-aware and intelligent, but otherwise little fuckers. They're like ugly and nasty and vindictive, and they swarm around you, and maybe they're good to eat, you know, these other things that I went, like, what if they had no redeeming qualities except for their self-awareness and intelligence? Thankfully, that's kind of what we get here with Mogworld. The main character is a zombie who has his eyes replaced by octopus eyes, which are so disgusting that when other people look at him, they want to vomit just by looking at him. And as I said before, he just continuously is a nasty person who hates everybody around him, and he sneers at people and he talks down to people, and the whole book is about this one guy who just can't believe how everybody around is so stupid. You know, and it's someone who is very, very unlikable, and someone who doesn't have any redeeming quality. Redeeming qualities, let me put it that way. He isn't fuzzy and nice, you know. And so once I got this kind of the comparison between Mogworld and life cycles of the life cycle of software objects, or life cycle of software objects by Ted Chiang, when it was in my mind and I started seeing those parallels, I couldn't really get them out of my head. And I must admit that Mogworld is a far superior treatment of the subject, mostly because life cycles of software objects, first of all, it didn't make me smile a single time, and I didn't like, despite the characters theoretically being nice, I didn't care for them at all. And Mogworld has just all of that complexity that was missing from the life cycles of software objects, because it has all that complexity. There's a zombie with octopus eyes, self-aware software entity that wants to be respected and wants to have rights and, like, human rights, and yet his main wish is that he wants to die and to be eradicated. And then the game developers of Mogworld, they have their own ideas. I don't want to go into it because there's a lot of stuff, lots of spoiler territories there. But they have conflicting plans. And, like, what happens in, like, the second half of the book where this really comes to a head and you're actually sort of seeing the what's going on behind the scenes a lot more, it's exactly what it wanted from the life cycle of software objects, because that was told from the point of view who are the people who developed the game or are nice and caring and they want to save these people. Oh, yes, it's all good and noble and stuff. And here we have, first of all, told from the opposite point of view, from the software objects point of view, back in, like, projecting back in the other direction and seeing things more from what their experience would have been like. You know, it's easy to say, well, what about Microsoft Word, or, you know, what about Frogger, or these other things, like, are these worth saving? And if you save them, what about the things that they have to run on? Well, we've got to run the software. And here, all of that, like, the tedious technicalities is at one step removed, and we actually see it from the ground, from where it's going stuff there. So, like, you know, the responsibility of creating self-aware entities, what happens at the end of this book is first of all, it took too long, and I think it was overdone, but it made me think, even though, like, it was clumsily plotted and written, it was actually made me think, and made me think about stuff in a way that I've not thought about these issues before, which brings to mind a quite an interesting scene, or one of my favourite scenes, or pretty much the defining scene in the novel Altered Carbon by Richard Morgan. And this character has kind of split himself into two, again, mild spoilers, and he flips a coin to decide which duplicate of him, or which version of him, is going to go on to become the real him, and which one is going to die. And these two characters, these two versions of the same character, flip a coin to decide who's going to live and die, and who's going to have continuity and who hasn't. And of course, that doesn't tie in with this novel so much, but it's one of those scenes which isn't about the issue, it's about the story. Like, it's about a character making a decision, and in doing that, brings up so many issues, so many all these themes about identity and all these other things that make me think, and like make me think about my own, like, identity and mortality in a different way than I ever have done before. And I had a similar reaction like that to various scenes in Mogworld. You know, you don't hammer home the importance of an issue like Ted Chiang does, when it's like, okay, now this is the issue, and here we go, and now this character is going to talk about this issue, and now they're going to talk about this issue. But like, if you have a character doing something which makes me view that same issue and same theme in a new light, that's what I really, really enjoy about science fiction, or about fiction in general. For example, in this book, there's a character, Slippery John. I've mentioned him a few times, mainly because he is he's one of my favourite characters. One of the reasons he is my favourite character is that he has a girlfriend, and this girlfriend is an adventure character who has been, you know, who has got the syndrome. And the syndrome means, of course, she has been taken over by a player, like a player has taken over her identity. So you've got someone who did at one point have free will, who's that free will has been taken over and subsumed into under the control of a player, like as a human player from outside of Mogworld. But then Slippery John still considers her a girlfriend, or maybe, I don't think she was a girlfriend, but now she is this syndrome thing. She's like a zombie, but not a real zombie, but like a mind zombie, that she doesn't have any self-awareness, and she is sometimes controlled by a player from outside. But Slippery John kind of marries her, and then he obviously kind of rapes her in a way, but then, like, is that consent? Because she doesn't have consent, because she's been taken away. But then he is a non-player controlled character. So he's a software entity raping a real character's in-game character. Self-aware entity, like raping a self-aware human's property, but within the game isn't self-aware, it's just human control. But that human control comes at the price of this other self-aware entity, their self-awareness being taken away and deleted. And so you just kept thinking, well, I was just thinking, like, okay, what's the ethical situation here? Is it like a robot raping a coma victim? And when you were thinking about that, a robot raping a coma victim, like, does it matter because it's just all software? But what's going on? But yeah, so this book is full of all of these, you know, different ways of viewing these things, but only at the end of the book does it become a bit more heavy-handed in the way, you know, in the style of life cycle of software objects. But up until that point, there's all of these different things, as I mentioned before, you know, these you know, the lampooning of religion, you know, where these going, well, the gods exist, and there's reincarnation as a fact of life or death, fact of life and death, and the afterworld may or may not exist, and there's, are gods real? Who are the gods? Who should go? And these religions over here, this priest over here, is he right? Should you follow this priest, or should you go to this church? You know, churches are obviously powerful because that's where people come back to life, so the people in the church, like the priest, should you take, you know, should you take notice of him, or is he just doing a ritual? You know, all of these great different ideas which are investigated, or like make me think about them in a way which I really enjoyed. Unfortunately, I don't think the book itself is as good as of a book as it is funny, because I think a lot of the funniness is clumsy, and it is actually detracts from the storytelling and the characterization. And also, a lot of these ideas that come along with it, they're not really supported by the good storytelling. You know, it's a pretty rough book. The characters and situations are well written and interesting, but they're put together in a way that feels too much like a sprawling game with side missions and random encounters. And I want something that's more of a novel from a novel. It might be intentional, maybe it's a criticism of game design that it feels sprawling, but I think in this way, that if you're going to write a novel, you can, there was enough criticism of game design and enough criticism of online role-playing games which could have been there with good structure and good novel and good writing, rather than this. So I don't think you can make excuses for that. And as I said, it is too long. Life Cycle of Software Objects felt like it was a short story expanded into a novella. This definitely feels more like a novella or a short novel expanded into a full novel, and I think it suffers a lot from that. For example, Yahtzee's videos are normally 5 minutes long. The zero punctuation videos are normally 5 minutes long, and they're just packed with every line is a joke, and every joke is accompanied by another joke on the screen, another visual joke, and all the way through. It's, you know, and looking at these games in ways that make you think and stuff. But this book is the opposite of that. Yahtzee talks too slowly, and the ideas and jokes are spread a little bit too thin. And the story can't really support everything that comes along with the story, like the subplots and the characters and the action and everything else. So overall, I'm going to give this book 3 stars. I think if you're a fan of the zero punctuation videos or that kind of stuff, you should give it a read. Or else, if you read The Life Cycle of Software Objects and didn't smile once, you could probably read this book or listen to this audiobook and get a lot out of it. I know I did, if you go into it knowing what to expect in that way. Anyway, that's about it from me. You can check me out on goodreads.com. You can follow my reviews there, and you can and join in the discussions in the SFBRP listeners group. I go here, and it seems like there's only one person who listens to this podcast seems to have reviewed this on goodreads.com. Joseph Dye rated it 3 stars, and nobody else has rated it at all. But what does it say here? Yeah, like the Goodreads rating average is 3.86 stars for Morgworld, but I think that's probably people who are already a fan of his, of Yahtzee Croshaw's videos, the zero punctuation videos and other things, probably give him a bit of a pass. I would give him a bit of a pass, but I also have to be a proper critic in this way. So yeah, otherwise you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge there, or you can email me. luke@juggler.net is my email address. Send me any feedback. The next book that I'm probably going to review is going to be Manhattan in Reverse. It's a short story collection by Peter F. Hamilton. I'll get to that. I'll probably do that review tomorrow. And we'll get onto the Solaris ones. And also World War, the alternative history, Aliens Invade During the Second World War series by Harry Turtledove. I've actually started the second book because I thought I'm just going to continue this. And then I'll just do a review when I get sick of this series enough to stop reading it or stop listening to it anymore. But we'll see how that goes as well. So that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.